Secretary Leavitt, probably wasn't fair to our viewers. You and Senator Harkin got into a little discussion as we were changing guests, and he said to you, if you have any recommendations for his legislation that's coming up in the Senate this week, let him know. What do you think about his legislation?
Well, the administration has been working with members of Congress. There will be a package that will be sent in the very near future to Congress from the administration, and I'm sure then between the two they'll put forward a package that I think will be quite responsive to the need.
What are the general broad outlines of what the administration's package will include?
Well, any comprehensive plan needs to have certain components to it. First of all, it does need to have surveillance. We need to know when this happens, as soon as it happens, so that we can be responsive in whatever the appropriate way is. That can range from going in with an international group to try to contain it somewhere else, or beginning to prepare our own cities and communities. We also need to have antivirals. We need to have vaccines. The conversation that you had with the senators, on point. We do not have manufacturing capacity in this country sufficient to produce a vaccine rapidly enough to be responsive, not just to this H5N1, but to any pandemic. And that's, I think, at the root of all of this discussion, is H5N1 may or may not be the virus that ultimately develops into a pandemic. Chances are it won't, but there are possibilities that it could, and therefore we have to be responsive. State and local preparedness is important, being able to speak to the community about it when it does in an authoritative, clear way so that people know what to do. Those are all part of a good pandemic plan.
A question about the part about global surveillance. The Senator Harkin's package has a $33 million in it. With the number of countries that we were looking at that have already had outbreaks, that doesn't sound like very much. How do you have surveillance for the countries, and how do you fund that?
I just returned from Southeast Asia, where I visited the five countries most most affected currently by the virus, where there have actually been people who have caught the virus. And we talked with the governments. I walked into wet markets and farms and throughout those the countryside to get a sense of what was on the ground. And frankly, it's a very difficult proposition, given the nature of the of those communities and the way they've lived for several hundred years, with their livestock being so much a part of their lives and living in close proximity. But the important thing is to have lab capacity and to have a medical network through those regions so that if there is an event that occurs, we know it. I visited the home of a family who contracted avian flu. They live in Vietnam, a little family of five, wonderful people. I went into their home, sat on their floor, talked to them about what had occurred to them. Their village ended up being one of those that needed to kill their chickens. It was a very important part of their livelihood. They made a decision not to, they killed their chickens, but the ones that weren't sick, they ate, or a number of them. And in the process of preparing the chicken, the father and a little girl became very ill, and they described their illness to me and how rapidly it happened and how frightening it was. And then they talked some about the way it had affected their community. We were able to ascertain that because they had a doctor in the village who knew about it, and the doctor knew it. Had they not, I fear they would have died. But they were able to be treated, and so the network of surveillance worked for them. But I said to them, you probably don't know this, but there were people all over the world watching very carefully to know whether or not how you were doing. In fact, the President of the United States asked many times about your well-being. That's a network, a worldwide network of surveillance. When it happens any place, there's risk everywhere, and we all have to be very conscious and create this network. Now, frankly, the network isn't what it needs to be, but we can make it better. And if we have time over the course of the next years, we can protect ourselves and the world from pandemics. We do have a short-term dilemma. Our network isn't what we'd like it to be, but the point is now we need to improve it.
Does your plan include anything that that would take care of the natural human reaction, which would be to, once, if this were to outbreak, every country would just, it's everybody for themselves? I mean, that's the general, a very human reaction to this.
Well, I think
where
it's
your
probably
surveillance wouldn't really work then.
Well, I think it's reality that if this happens, every nation will immediately begin to say, what do we have and how do we best use it? Now, there may be an interest in our on all of our parts, every nation's, to say, if this happens in a small village in Laos or Cambodia, maybe we're better off as an international community to get there rapidly I'm going to Canada this afternoon to meet with health ministers to talk about that very thing. What can we do as an international community to be prepared? We need to not just be willing, we need to have exercised it so that when it happens, we can get there quickly.
We're going to be covering, I think, that actual hearing. This is with the Canadian health ministers and also other health officials?
Yes. This has actually been, I pulled all of the health ministers together from the affected countries earlier in the spring in Geneva, and we had a conversation about it. I've had lengthy conversations with health ministers from all over the world, in addition to the Southeast Asian trip that I just completed. If you think of the world as a vast forest that's susceptible to fire, if there's a forest fire, it started with a spark. And if you can be right there when the spark happens, you can simply put it out with your foot. If you're not, it can grow and to the point very rapidly that it's not containable. And so as an international community, one of the things we need to do is to be ready if that opportunity presents itself.
Charleston, Georgia, you're first up for the Secretary. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning.
I had three questions I need to ask. I don't know if she's going to let me ask them or cut me off.
You just keep trying and I'll keep answering.
For support calls for the Democrats. I support President Bush. First question is, explain to the people why very little vaccine, if any, is made in this country. Isn't it because during the Clinton administration they tried to force the vaccine companies to sell the vaccine to the government at less than their cost? Explain why the drugs cost so much less outside the country. I stop in Mexico every week because I run from Georgia to California to fill prescription drugs for elderly people here. Explain why, because the lawyers are allowed to sue the drug companies for such outrageous amounts of money, they have to make more profit to be able to stay in business. And the senator brought up money's got to be come up with for this flu. Well, I watched the Senate on C-SPAN 2 the other day. They were arguing about a park in Washington that was going to cost $585 million. And this was part of the pork bills that was put in the transportation, which he brought up, transportation bill. Part of the pork brought in there. And some senator, a Republican senator, brought up, let's cut some of this pork out. And the Democratic senators were having a fit. This park in Washington, I understand, was some kind of monument park. They were going to build statues and monuments in there, some kind of a neighborhood economy build-up thing, yet they didn't want to cut it out.
Charleston, thank you. I think we got your point. All four of them.
Well, let's start first of all with vaccines. Mm-hmm. This is a long story. I mean, it's probably 25 years. We have allowed the manufacturing industry, the vaccine manufacturing industry, to essentially go into a state of disrepair where we don't have the capacity. Most of it was the fact that it was not a good business for the vaccine manufacturers. There has to be a level of certainty that people will be there to buy your product before people will invest money in it, and therefore there may be a compelling national interest for the government to make certain that there's a level of certainty that if you manufacture this, there's at least a chance you'll sell it. That's among the ideas that we're now exploring. We do need to dramatically invest, not just in assuring that there will be an industry there to make it, but to move to new technologies so that we're on the cutting edge. We're seeing that manifest in our annual flu. People are worried right now about pandemic flu that hasn't come, but we are now entering the flu season for the ordinary flu, something we know that will happen. And in years past, we haven't had vaccines sufficient to immunize our people for the ordinary flu or annual flu, which takes about 36,000 lives a year. So this business of creating an infrastructure that can give us vaccines is a very important part of the stability of a country and the health of our communities.
Suing the drug companies.
That's part of it.
Drug companies, have to give them indemnity?
You know, the entire vaccine industry generates about $8 billion a year. In any given year, you could have $30, $40 billion in lawsuits when people find that they had a vaccine that they were unhappy with the outcome. And anytime you're dealing with a vaccine, there are occasional negative outcomes. And we do need to provide a sense of certainty, again, to the vaccine manufacturers that unless there's something egregiously wrong where they have systematically gone about in ways to hurt someone, we've got to be able to find ways to either compensate people or give indemnity to the insurance company, to the manufacturers, or both.
And coming up with the money.
Well, this is a very tough time to come up with money, but now is the point in which we're facing this H5N1 virus. What's the probability that it will be the virus that sets off the pandemic? No one knows, but it's not zero. And we do need to be prepared for pandemics in general, and now's the time for us to be responding to this.
Out to the West Coast now for the Secretary, Long Beach, California. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
The last caller like took my my questions away from me, but I do have a couple more. Since the vaccine companies are protected for, let's say, if they were the, there was a vaccine with mercury in it or something like that from getting sued, is that basically the reason why they're not manufacturing stuff like that here in the United States?
It's a very big part of it. They have been, first of all, you say this is a business where you're not sure there'll be somebody there to buy your product, and second of all, you're likely to get sued in a way that will cost you more money in lawsuits and in expenses than you would ever earn. People in the manufacturing business believe they've got better options, and in some respects, the public health then is not well cared for. There is a compelling interest, national interest, for us to have a stable, ongoing manufacturing sector of vaccines, and we need to get about it.
Las Vegas, go ahead.
Yes, I agree with the World Network that you have going here, where you're watching for outbreaks of this flu in various parts of the world and so forth, and trying to contain it. And of course, naturally, the shots that people should take. However, if we can't control drugs from coming in this country, if we can't control illegals from coming in this country, how in the world are we going to prevent something like a flu like this to come in the country? And don't you think it's important to control our borders and ports to at least eliminate or bring down the degree of this epidemic, other epidemics like this, from coming into our country?
The answer to all those points is yes. I mean, the reality is it's very difficult to keep a virus like this out if, in fact, it is spreading human to human. There are times when people have the virus and they're spreading it, but they're not symptomatic yet. Another problem is that this is currently being spread by wild birds who fly across international flyways. It's now in Turkey and I think there's worry about it being in Greece and in Ukraine, and it will just keep going. There's no reason to think that these birds are going to stop there. They'll continue to go throughout the world. The good news is it has not reached a level of efficiency that it transmits to humans. This is fundamentally right now, or at least primarily, an animal disease. It's very slight risk that humans in its current form will be able to contract it. But the worry, of course, is that it will continue to mutate and will become efficient, and we need to be ready. If it's not this virus, it will be another. And our big worry here is not, in my mind, is not just H5N1. It's being ready in the long run as these circumstances will inevitably mature in the future.
Black Mountain, North Carolina.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah. I think, like the other callers have pointed out, that our government isn't capable of protecting us from viruses, but you are effective at producing fear in society. Probably to sell products like Tamiflu that are major stockholders of Donald Rumsfeld. Can you acknowledge that not one human has spread avian flu to another human? 60 deaths worldwide. How many people have died from AIDS? What are you doing about AIDS? Why don't you talk to us about what's going on, or other problems that are killing hundreds of thousands of people in society here?
This is a very tough issue to maintain perspective on. On one hand, we're trying to find the balance between informing people and inflaming them. If this were to unfold the way the pandemic of 1918 did, it would be a world-changing event. And for us not to do all we can to provide information would be simply wrong. On the other hand, the caller's right. We have had 120 people who've received it. They get it primarily from birds. There have been cases that we think may well have been transmitted person to person, but not efficiently. The worry is that this is a shifting scene. We have, and it's following a pattern that is troublesome. And we don't have any idea what happened in 1918 and the years prior to this that catastrophic pandemic. But scientists are worried, and well, they should be. But our big concern right now is to get ready for pandemics in general and to do all we can to be ready should this mature in the short run.
This emailer asks, you mentioned a family in Vietnam who had the virus. What village was this in Vietnam, and did it border Cambodia or Laos?
It did not. It was in Haiphong, or a little suburb village commune of Haiphong, which is the third largest city, but a very rural area. This was, as I indicated, a delightful family. Three little children, the father and the mother have chickens, and they grow a little rice wine that they sell at restaurants to make their living. They're probably similar to most other Vietnamese families. I think probably an average income of $700 to $1,000 a year, dependent on their chickens and their livestock. So it was an economic blow to them, which really illustrates the cross pressure that so many are under. And it does point out how difficult it is to contain this kind of a disease in a culture like that, or anywhere in Southeast Asia. And so having a network of surveillance is important, but it's also important that we're realistic about the chances of being able to contain it. We'll have to make decisions. That's one of the reasons I went to Southeast Asia, is to have a sense of what's happening on the ground. What does this look like where it actually occurs? And it was a very insightful, helpful and insight-building experience for me.
At what point in time did you decide to go by yourself to look into a wet market, which is what you talked about in your news conference the other day? When did you decide you wanted to be alone and do that?
It just seemed essential to me. If I were to understand the conditions that this virus likely would be discovered in, it's not inconceivable at all that at some point in the future, as Secretary of Health and Human Services, I would be called out to make a decision. Should we deploy assets of the United States that we don't have an overabundance of to try to contain a disease in a small village in Laos or Cambodia? It's hard to do that if you haven't had a chance to see what it's like there. And it was a helpful experience. I sat down at the feet of people who were cleaning chickens and asked them about their life. I sitting next to a pen of pigs. I was in one market where a woman had traveled 600 kilometers over the night to bring a load of pigs on a bus, in a cage on top of a bus next to a group of chickens. I woke her up in the market as she was sleeping there. So there you have it: pigs and birds and animals all in the same place. And this has gone on for centuries. It's not like we're going to be able to change that. So we have to deal with the reality of the situation we're in.
I take it you took a translator with you when you went out
there.
I did. And what was the reaction of these people to see an American in the middle of their market asking them these kinds of questions?
You know, the Southeast Asian people are kind and gentle people for the most part, and they were very open and willing to talk to me. And most of them had heard about avian flu, but it didn't seem real to them because, well, first of all, they were about the. I talked to a woman there who described as her life as we're fighting for our lives, and I don't think she meant to imply that life was bad for her. I think it just meant that every day was about getting up and finding a way to put food on their table and to make certain that their children and their families were well cared for. It's a much different culture than what we live in, and yet we're linked to them in a very real way. If avian flu develops into a human-to-human transmittable virus, we're all in this one together, because if it's anywhere, there's risk everywhere.
Did you get a feel from these people that they would be willing to give up that livelihood, that they're fighting for their daily lives, that livelihood with many of them with poultry, for that person halfway across the world that you were representing at that time?
You know, they wouldn't do it for us. They'd only do it for them. I mean to imply that the family I met who killed their chickens did it because the leader of their village said we need to do it, and they killed 8,000 birds in the course of a very short period of time. I asked the woman what she thought when she heard that her husband and her daughter had avian flu. She said something very important. She said, my first concern was to find ways to get money so that their care could continue. She was under the impression that if they could not find money, that the care would stop. That shows the link between a healthcare system, a healthcare network. Had she not had, or he not had, a village doctor who was well informed to look for those symptoms, he would have presented himself in the first 2 hours of that illness, as he described it to me. He had a cough that got progressively worse, and he had a fever and he felt nauseous. But there are 100 diseases that start out that way. Then within 2 hours, he became excruciatingly ill. And had the doctor not known that it was happening, I'm sure he would have joined the other 50% who died. It demonstrates the importance of a domestic surveillance network. So we've talked a lot about the surveillance network outside the United States. We need one inside the United States. We need doctors in emergency rooms and nurses like the one who called earlier who understand and know what this is about, so that they can respond and that we can begin to exercise the kind of tools and public health practices we know how to use in this country.
Next is Cleveland. Hello.
Hi. Good morning, Secretary Leavitt. I have a question kind of concerning the way that the flu virus, I'm sorry.
You're doing fine.
How do we make the inoculations for it? From what I've read, there are times where birds do not show any signs of being affected, and I know that they are making the vaccine from the eggs, actually. I guess my question is kind of a simple, everyday life question. How do we know, or do we know, about any products that we are eating or that are coming into the country as food sources, or that we have here, if we had an infected chicken population here that we didn't know about? How do we know about the food sources? And as far as that goes, pigs also.
Well, you've raised a number of issues. Let me just say, every time I leave the country and go into certain parts of the world, not every part of the world, but I say a little word of appreciation for the Food and Drug Administration, because we do have a very well defined distribution network of safety. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good, and that's one of the reasons they're there, is to make certain that things aren't being imported that could in some way cause us harm. You ask a question about how we make the vaccines. The vaccines are made actually from eggs. They're poultry eggs. There are birds that can be sick but not show symptoms, but the vaccines are made from very specially protected and managed flocks of poultry, and they're able to actually cultivate the vaccine within the egg, and we're now looking at a new and more efficient way that would be much faster, less expensive, we hope, and more reliable, called cell-based, but I won't take the time to talk about that today.
If Congress did not give the monies to increase the vaccine within this country, would you approve of it being outsourced in other countries, to be made in other countries?
That's a very hard question, but I think you answered it earlier. I think if we had an outbreak, we're on our own. I think we'll have what we can manufacture here.
Next is Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning.
Good morning. Is Traverse City, did you say?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning to you both. I have a question, and the parrot in Great Britain is a prime example of why I'm asking this. Are we going to shut our doors to the importation of exotic birds? I don't believe that Aunt Millie needs another parakeet, and I believe that if we don't shut our doors to the importation of exotic birds, that the first time avian flu comes here will be through exotic birds. Thank you.
Well, we do have a system of being able to check, and I don't know at this moment what the policy is with those who are responsible for that, but the incident in England made it very clear that that's an avenue that we need to be conscious of.
Goose Creek, South Carolina.
Good morning.
Morning.
I beg to differ with the senator. our country certainly is capable of making these vaccines. It's money. When my grandson died from a pertussis shot 21 years ago, the doctors called a meeting and told us at that time it's because it was produced overseas and not as pure as it should be. If memory serves me right, we pulled Chrysler out of a financial disaster. Why could we not manufacture with clarity and purity those vaccines we need here and pull those drug companies out of the bind if they need it? And also, as far as the avian flu contaminating our poultry and perhaps our pork, reach into our freezers this year and serve our Thanksgiving dinners for food we already have on hand, and reach in again and get one for a needy family. Money is being wasted on all fronts, and those people in New Orleans are still suffering dreadfully. Florida is doing great with their hurricane problems. Thank you.
You know, I fear we may have miscommunicated with the caller, because we do have a fine manufacturing sector in the United States. We just don't have enough of it. We don't have the capacity to do it in large enough quantities, and we don't have enough of them doing it. So we are going to work, well, let's just say we're going to work in a rigorous and robust way to bring that back. And we'll all be better off. This will be a healthier country as a result of this. Even if H5N1 does not become the virus that causes a pandemic, there will be another. And we need this capacity. It's part of a fundamental strategy for a safe and healthy nation.
She mentioned her grandson dying 20-some years ago, which is probably when this, in the aftermath of the last vaccine,
it could have been.
We didn't really check with her on that. Are you going to face that, some of the people who came out of that last vaccine, and there were a lot of problems with it? Are you going to face that as a stumbling block in trying to do what the administration wants to do in terms of more vaccine?
Inevitably, we will. I've read a lot, studied a lot, I've had the benefit of being tutored by the best scientists in the world who are at the CDC and NIH and others. But one of the most important things I read was a business case written by two doctors who studied the swine flu scare, and I think that's the right term, we had in 1976, where mistakes were made in the way we responded to that. We began to vaccinate people before there was a real presentation of the virus. There was one case, and we overreacted. So we're, part of our plan will be the creation of a doctrine that defines when we believe we have a triggered event that causes us to respond. Sometimes finding, again, this balance between informing people and inflaming them is a very difficult balance to make. And the only way you can deal with that is to just give people information, do the best you can to tell them the truth, and let decisions be made both collectively and individually on that basis.
We'll see you a lot this week. You're going to be in front of the National Press Club. Our viewers will see you there. When can we expect, though, you to present the administration's plan, or will the president be presenting it?
That will happen very soon. The president is highly interested in this, as I think you know, and he has been moving this forward since spring. We first began having Oval Office meetings on this in the spring. It's become more prominent in the last few months, but his interest began months and months ago.
So we should expect him to make the announcement, or you?
Well, I think you'll see some of both.
Okay. Secretary Leavitt, thank you very much for coming in and joining and talking to our viewers today.